for sending my son to Israel. But it's really just amazing. He's in an Israeli institution. It's called the Hesder Yeshiva, where they combine army service and Torah study. It's a five-year program. You think fellowships is a commitment? This is a commitment. The army is 3 years in Israel, but if you do Hesder, then they combine the army service. They knock down the army part to 18 months, but then it's sandwiched in between with biblical and Talmudic studies, and they make up some of the best units in the army, and they're a very sort of gung-ho group, and every one of these Hesder, not all of them, but most of the Hesder yeshivot have like foreign student programs. So my son is on one of those, and get to just be around just amazing, amazing people, teachers and mentors, and their colleagues who are doing the army and learning, and just really beautiful. And it was a great trip, minus getting sick. But I guess if you have to get sick, you know. So what I want to do with you guys tonight is start this packet. We're just going to do literally the first page. And this, I would argue, is probably the most important series that we'll have in the Next Level series for the whole year. And I started with this because this is the basis. I really believe that in order to fully appreciate everything that comes later in the year, our discussions about Shabbat and about Kashrut and about all the holidays and about Lashon Hara, not speaking ill of our neighbor, about giving charity, literally every single thing that we will be studying will be based on this next 4 or 5 weeks. And literally everything in Judaism, not to be overly dramatic, but is really based and premised on understanding how we got from Sinai to Manhattan. And I say Manhattan because that's just where we happen to be. I made that up. What I want to ask you tonight is a very simple question. And I want to try to explore this question this evening and get into more nitty-gritties in the weeks to come. We have two big questions before us. Number one, where does the Torah come from? Why do at least some Jews still believe that the Torah that we observe is divine in origin? What is the basis for that? Is that just an article of faith that you either believe in or you don't? We're going to talk about that tonight. And once we discuss that, even if you accept the divinity of the Torah, that it wasn't written by people or even great scholars, how do you get like the Judaism that we observe today? You go into a kosher kitchen and they've got the meat pots and pans, and it doesn't say that anywhere in the five books of Moses. And in fact, you know, it doesn't even, you see men getting up in the morning, and I was at the Kotel at the Wall. It's like one of the largest gatherings at the Wall over the holiday of Sukkot, and there's just like thousands of thousands of men putting on these, you know, these leather black straps called tefillin. Like, it doesn't say the word, it doesn't say tefillin anywhere in the Torah. There's no description of what they look like. And yet, it's part of the daily rituals of what we do. I've got these little tzitzit, the fringes on. Like, all the details and all the things that make up our observances and practices and all the things we don't do on Shabbat or we do on Shabbat, like, you know, see if you can find them in the five books. They're not exactly there. And where do they come from? And how do we practice our Judaism to this day? Where is this? How did this whole thing develop? And that's really what I want to spend the next couple of weeks with you on. I want to say something at the outset. I don't pretend to have all the answers. I have been teaching this for many years, and I love teaching this stuff, and I like demonstrating that there is a rational basis to believing in the divine origin of the Torah, and that I can point to things, and I study a lot of Talmud, but that doesn't mean I have all the answers. So please ask. I'll try my best to answer. But last time I checked, the finite can never really grasp entirely the infinite, but we're gonna try a little tonight. You with me? That's my introduction and my caveat. Please record. I'm actually recording this as well, but please record. Absolutely. And if you'll notice, I took away the Facebook Live. Yay. That's going on Monday night. it's too cramps everybody's style here too much. Okay, so we're going to start in the Torah itself. Who can read the opening verse on the top of the page? Anybody would like to volunteer in English? Just go for it. David.
The Israelites saw the great power that God had unleashed against Egypt, and the people were in awe of God. They believed in God and his servant Moses.
Excellent. Who can give me the context of that verse?
Which is taken from the book of Exodus. Anybody else need a packet? We got an extra packet here. We got okay.
What is that? David just read it. The Israelites saw the great power that God unleashed against Egypt. So it's obviously happening during the days of the Egypt, this slavery, right? And the people were in awe of God, and they believed in God and his servant Moses. It's actually part of the prayers. This verse is incorporated into our daily prayers. What's the context? What event does this verse speak about or immediately follow?
It's the shrine and that God controls, or he controlled, it's the shrine already, he controls everything.
Okay, so what you, it's Tziat Mitzrayim means the Exodus, but the Exodus is very broad. The ten plagues, you're getting closer. The splitting of the Red Sea. Now, listen, I pulled it out of the... I can't expect you to know this. I'm just... But I want everyone to understand. This is what the Torah says to describe the reaction of the Jewish people in the immediate aftermath of... Not the ten plagues. What happened after the tenth plague?
Sea split.
Right? The Jewish people finally get out of Egypt. Pharaoh's had enough. Take your people and go. He then changes his mind, sends his Egyptian legions, his chariots, his horsemen running after the Jews. They're freaking out because on one side is the Sea of Reeds and the other side are the Egyptians. What do we do? What do they do? What happens? They walk. The sea splits miraculously. They go forward. What happens to the Egyptians? They follow suit. The Jews can do it. We can do it. And what happens to the Egyptian legions in that sea? They drown according to the Torah. They are drowned in that sea, and the Jewish people see this, and they're like, whoa, they believe. I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, assuming it all happened. If this happened to you, wouldn't you believe? That's what the Torah says. They believed in God and his servant Moses. Not that Moses was a god, but that he was really an authentic messenger of God, like he was claiming to be. Here's the problem, though. A couple of verses later... David, continue to read, would you mind? Exodus chapter 19. This is now how many chapters later? The verse you just read was from 14. This is five chapters later. Go.
I will come to you in a thick cloud so that all the people will hear when I speak to you. They will then also believe in you forever.
Who can tell me what that event is referring to? Now that event has taken place or not? Look at the tense. Is it a past, present, or future? It's a future tense, so the event that it's referring to hasn't yet happened. Does anybody know what event that is referring to that hasn't happened? Think about it from your Hebrew days, Hebrew school days. What happened after the splitting of the Red Sea? What was the next event?
Getting
the Ten Commandments, the giving of the Torah at Sinai. What does God say here? I will come to you in a thick cloud. God used to actually appear to the Jewish people. God doesn't have a physical countenance or presence, but he would use a cloud. One of the reasons we sat in a sukkah on the holiday was because it's supposed to represent not only the physical huts that our ancestors lived when they left Egypt, but the cloud of glory. God would appear to the nation in the form of a cloud. I will come to you in a thick cloud so all the people will hear when I speak to you. Who's God speaking to here? Speak to you is referring to a singular person, Moses, Moshe. They will then also believe in you forever. When did the giving of the Torah take place? Before the splitting of the Red Sea or after the splitting of the Red Sea? It took place after. So what's the problem? What's that? Well, you're ready, but don't assume everyone's picking up on the problem. What seems to be like a contradiction between the two verses? Right. What does it say after the splitting of the Red Sea? Vayaminu b'Hashem, they believed in God, u'b'Moshe avdo, and his servant Moses. Five chapters earlier. Now, even if you say that the way the Torah records things is not according to the chronological, historical order of things, which some people believe, by the way, that's a debate amongst the early rabbis, Yesh muktam u'me'ochar ba'torah, or ein muktam u'me'ochar ba'torah. Can you say that something happened later just because it appears in a later chapter? Not necessarily, but everybody believes that before the Jews stood at Sinai, they got out of Egypt. And they only got out of Egypt because the sea split. So if the Red Sea split first, and what does it say after the Red Sea was split? What does it say? They believed in God and His servant Moses. Then how come later, when God tells Moshe, He starts preparing him for the giving of the Torah at Sinai, what does He say to him? All right, try not to think of any answers yet. I just want you to get the question. Because the most profound truths in Judaism are always found when you stumble across things that look like they contradict each other. Why would God then tell Moshe, then they'll believe in you? What do you mean, then? Don't they believe already? Was the splitting of the Red Sea not enough? I asked you guys a minute ago, if you were there, would you not believe? Why is it that, so what, between chapter 14 and chapter 19, they believed and then they forgot? They lost it? What was happening? And why is it that the revelation at Sinai would be necessary for their belief? We need the revelation at Sinai to get the Torah. We need to know how to live. But the belief comes from the miracle of the splitting of the Red Sea.
Well, when we left in Egypt there, we were very low. We were doing everything wrong. Okay? We could have been idolaters, but you're right. So we saw Moshe right then when he split the sea and everything, and he stretched out his arms. So perhaps the people thought that Moshe was the one doing it.
That's interesting. Maybe that's an interesting answer. That maybe people attributed, you know, all of these incredible miracles. But why does the Torah then say that after the splitting of the Red Sea, they believed in God? It doesn't say they believed in Moshe. It says also Moshe, but it starts with God.
Also, the second one isn't talking about believing in God. That's talking about believing in Moses.
Oh. The second one says, then they'll also believe in you. But what does it mean to believe in Moshe? We don't know. The reason we don't know where Moses is buried, the rabbis teach, is because we never wanted his grave to become a shrine. And that's probably what would have happened. Because he was so close to God and he was the greatest prophet. But Judaism prides itself on seeing people as people and not deifying our leaders, as great and holy as they were. So I can't read that as they'll believe in you. The whole point is to believe in Moshe. No. Point is to believe in God. Moshe was a necessary representative of God. But follow with me to the Rambam, Maimonides. I'm going to be quoting the Maimonides a lot here. On the next source, in chapter 8. Everybody here knows who the Rambam was. Quickly, he lived about 800 years ago.
He was about to go to rabbi.
He was made his parents very proud, a doctor and a rabbi. Not a lawyer, unfortunately, but he knew a lot more law than most lawyers do. He lived in Spain and then had to flee to Egypt, and he was an extraordinary philosopher and also codified the entire Talmud into this book that he called the Mishneh Torah with 14 sections, and this is the chapter 8 of the first section called the Yisodei HaTorah. Listen to what he writes. Now, Maimonides also was a rationalist. He considered himself a student of Aristotle, the great Greek philosopher, and he liked to play down supernatural things. He couldn't deny supernatural events like the splitting of the Red Sea. You know, the Torah is filled with miracles. But what's the purpose of a miracle? As far as Judaism is concerned, follow with me. The Jews did not believe. Anybody want to read this? We have another volunteer. Another volunteer in the crowd over here. Guys? Can we? I want to include some others. Go for it. Stephanie.
The Jews did not believe in Moses, our teacher, because of the wonders that he performed. Whenever anyone's belief is based on wonders, he has misgivings, because it is possible to perform a wonder through magic or sorcery. All the wonders performed by Moses in the desert were not intended to serve as proof of the legitimacy of his prophecy, but rather were performed for a purpose. It was necessary to drown the Egyptians, so he split the sea and sank them in it. We needed food, and he provided us with manna. We were thirsty, so he split the rock, providing us with water. Korah's band mutinied against him, so the earth swallowed them up. The same applies to the other wonders.
Okay, stop for a minute. You see what the Rambam's doing here? He can't deny that the Torah is filled with miracles, but what's their point? Their point is not to inspire faith. Now, when I first read this, I was like, really? That's kind of like what you would think. And the Rambam is a singular voice on this. Most of the other rabbis disagree with him on this point, but I think it's a very, very important idea to express. Why is the Rambam skeptical of the efficacy of, not the efficacy, but of the power of a miracle to inspire faith? Because what happens when you see a miracle? I mean, what happens, just imagine today, you're at work, and then you look out the window, and then all of a sudden you see a guy flying, a human being flying, or something that looks really strange and supernatural. What do you do automatically? You take a video and send it to your friends. I'm not crazy. What do you do? What happens in your mind? Break it down for a minute. Just what goes on, what happens cognitively? We try to rationalize it. We try to explain it. And the Rambam says that anyone's belief is based on wonders. There's always a misgiving, because you always wonder, how did that happen? Now, when the Rambam lived in the 1100s, magic and sorcery, black magic also, was actually very big and in. And that's what people's minds would go. Where would your mind go today? If you saw something that looked miraculous, supernatural, you would think it's probably some computer-generated optical illusion of some sort, right? All the wonders, therefore, performed by Moshe were therefore not intended to serve as proof of the legitimacy of his prophecy. It was not to prove that there was a God or that this Torah came from God, because it would never have worked very well. Why wouldn't it have worked well? Because people would go, was that really him? Was that really a sea split? Maybe it was split by some other force. I mean, the Egyptians, you know the word Ra comes from, which means evil or bad. Ra was the sun god of Egypt. They worshipped the sun god. They said that was the source of light, of heat, of warmth in the world. And they worshipped the Nile. And they worshipped this. Now, every part of nature was worshipped. And therefore, when Moshe... So why did Moshe perform wonders and miracles, if not to inspire faith? Very simple. If you got to get the Jews from this side of the river to that side of the river, and you can perform a miracle, it's a lot easier to do it supernaturally than naturally or normally, right? And if you're God, you're in the desert, there are no 7-Elevens in the desert, you got millions of Jews who need to be fed every day, what are you going to do? You're going to have them plant seeds and trees and blah, 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 da, da, da. What are you going to do? You're going to drop man from the heavens, because you're God and you can do that. But you're not doing that to inspire faith. You're doing that to get stuff done for purely utilitarian, practical ends. So the Rambam is left with a question, though. If miracles exist in the Bible, but they're not there to inspire faith, and why are they there not to inspire faith? Because they really won't give you much faith. Then what will? What is the source, look at the next paragraph, of our belief in God? If it ain't the splitting of the Red Sea, if it's not the manna falling from the heavens, then what is it? And he answers what we're here to talk about tonight, the revelation at Sinai, which Maimonides does not describe as a miracle. Because there was really nothing miraculous. Yes, the mountain was supposed to have been shaking, and yes, God made his voice audible in human terms. I guess those are all supernatural types of things. But there's no sea splitting, there's no man falling, there's no, you know, Nile turning into blood, frogs popping out of people's ovens like all the 10 plagues. It's just God speaking to the people. And Maimonides distinguishes between that and a miracle. I always thought to myself, like, well, why didn't they just consider that another miracle, the giving of the Torah at Sinai? It's not. It's a conversation. And that, says Maimonides, is the source of our faith. And that, he says, answers our original question. What was the original question between the verses, guys? The first verse said that after the splitting of the Red Sea, they believed in God and his servant Moses. And then a couple of chapters later, God is speaking to Moshe and he's preparing them for the giving of the Torah, and what does he say? Then they'll believe in you forever. What word is different between the two beliefs in those two verses? Did you figure that out yet? The word forever. Miracles will produce faith, but not forever. Miracles will inspire you. They'll shake up your, they'll rattle your cage a bit, but they're not going to get you to change your life permanently. The only thing that will change your life and get you to see the truth on a permanent basis is something which lasts, and which isn't something that you're going to say to yourself, what was that? Who caused that? You see, the Jews didn't have to do that when it came to the giving of the Torah at Sinai, but they had to do that every time the man fell from the heaven. Where did that come from? Maybe there was some meteorological weird kind of stuff going on, and it formed this and it created that. You know, the science edition of the New York Times many years ago, before Passover, came out with a fascinating article recording some scientific discussion about the 10 plagues. And that some algae got into the Nile, which caused the thing to turn into blood, and the frogs came out, and they were trying to explain scientifically and rationally the 10 plagues, because that's what we do. And that's okay. God gave us a brain to use in that way, as long as we don't become ridiculous, which is what it was starting to get after plague 4, 5, or 6. But that's what we do. And because you could always ask the question, what was behind it? The Jews at Sinai never needed to ask that question, because they were talking not to a miracle, but to the source of all miracles, to God Himself. And that's why we make such a big deal about that event. An event which did not take place simply to Moshe. Now Moshe would have to then go and transmit this information to the rest of the people. What happened at Sinai? Every man, woman, and child who was alive at the time was present when the Torah was given. And God spoke to the Jewish people. How many, what did He give over at that time? Just technically, do you remember? What did He give? He gave over the Ten Commandments. According to the Talmud, the original intention was to give over all 613. But it appeared that the Jews couldn't handle it. And according to some opinions, they didn't even hear all 10. They heard 2. And according to another opinion in the Talmud, they heard 1. It was too awesome of a spiritual experience. They turned back to Moshe and they said, we can't do this anymore. You get the rest. But the original, the implication is that God was going to reveal every aspect of Judaism directly from Himself to the people themselves, not leaving any of these questions, where is it coming from, who was it? The source for our belief in Torah and in God is not miracles. It's the Torah. It's specifically this event of the giving of the Torah at Sinai. And if you take a look at the next page, turn the page, please. I want to share with you something really fascinating. At the end of the Torah, in the book of Deuteronomy, Sefer Dvarim, there is a section called the Navi Sheker, which means the false prophet. Are you guys familiar with any false prophets? Prophets who've come along since Moses' day and tried to claim that they were either the Messiah or a new prophet, and they had a new message. Yeah, we got a couple of big religions. This little thing called Christianity started that way. Right? So what does the Torah say to do? Follow with me in the middle of the page, Deuteronomy chapter 13. Anybody want to read? We've got another volunteer. Please? Yeah?
If there arise among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, and he gives you a sign or a wonder, and the sign or the wonder of which he spoke to you comes to pass, and he says, let us go after other gods, which you have not known, and let us serve them. Do not listen to the words of that prophet or dreamer. God is your Lord, testing you to see if you are truly able to love God, your Lord, with all your heart and all your soul.
Okay, so this prophet or dreamer comes along and gives you a sign or a wonder. Now, why does it give you a sign or a wonder? What does that mean, a sign or a wonder? By the way, this happened numerous times in Jewish history, where somebody comes along and they say, no, this is really the proper path. This is really what God wants of me. I'm the authentic messenger of God. And how do they try to prove it? Always? Miracles. Listen to what the Rambam, Maimonides, writes on this verse below.
Therefore, I'm just going to continue, thank you. If a prophet arises and attempts to dispute Moses' prophecy by performing great signs and wonders, we don't listen to him, because we know with certainty that he was able to perform those signs through magic or sorcery. I mean, that's what the Rambam said then. Right? Through some other power. This conclusion is reached because the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, is not dependent on wonders, so that we could compare these wonders one against the other. Rather, we saw and heard with our own eyes and ears as he did. Think about this for a minute. Why is it that the Jew was never moved by subsequent prophets who came along? And by the way, maybe they did. Jesus claimed he walked on water. We were in the Kinneret. That's why a lot of Christian tourists come through and like to go to the Kinneret, into that area, because that's where Jesus was supposed to have walked. Do we start getting into a whole thing? Maybe did he walk? Did he not walk? It doesn't matter. Let's say he did it. Maybe he was able to pull it off spiritually or through some sort of magic. Who knows? Our faith is not based on a miracle such that it would now somehow be contradicted by someone else's miracle. Think about the way we would live our lives. We think about why are we believing in Moshe and in the Torah? Because of all the fancy miracles that he did, the 10 plagues, the splitting of the Red Sea. So if somebody comes along with something at least as good, maybe I should pay attention to him or her. But my faith is not based on a miracle such that it would be, use the Talmudic language, upslugged by some other better miracle. Is that the way we're going to make important decisions? What religion to follow in our lives? Who's more impressive? This guy split the sea, this guy walked on it. No. Maimonides says is that our faith is based on what? An experience. A direct encounter with God himself. Not an indirect encounter with a miracle that may or may prove something or not.
Why don't we need Moshe to get out of
this? Well, let me just finish the whole point. I'll tell you. Rather, we saw and heard with our own eyes and ears as he did. To what can this be compared? To witnesses who gave testimony concerning a matter. To a man who observed the situation with his own eyes. He will never listen to them and will know for certain that they are false witnesses. Therefore, the Torah states, even if such a sign or a wonder will come to pass, you should not listen. He comes to you with signs and wonders to deny what you saw with your own eyes. Now, I want to stop here for a minute. I think this is a pretty solid, if you were there, if I was there, if any of us was actually at Sinai, and we're one of those, how many people were at Sinai, we believe?
6,000, 7,000.
Right, so there was a census, a military census taken. So I'm going to extrapolate. If there were 600,000 men between 20 and 60, you know, military age, then we're going to say anywhere between 2 and 3 million people, men, women, and children. If any one of us was there, and it would be like when we experienced that, and we have a lot of confidence in this Torah. Like, I was there, I heard it. Right? I didn't have to be proven by anyone. Moses didn't have to do anything cool and fancy because I heard God. And I believe the voice I heard was not a hallucination. I wasn't on anything at the time. I really, you know, heard this and I experienced this directly. The problem that we have in 2017 is we weren't there. Now, I know maybe some have heard this Kabbalistic statement that we were there. The Kabbalah teaches that every man, woman, and child, Jewish or who would become Jewish one day, was at Sinai. Their souls were there. Saw you at Sinai. That's where the website comes from, right? Your soul was there. I remember as a kid, like, I used to feel so guilty because I couldn't remember it. You know, I was like, maybe I was talking. Maybe I was sitting in the back, you know, and like it was going on. And I mean, now I do believe, and I can't prove this obviously, but that there is this idea in the Kabbalah that somehow we have this connection to that place and to that moment. But I'm going to be a total rationalist because consciously we weren't there. So it would really be great based on everything we've studied in the Rambam if we were. But we weren't. So we're skeptical. We're skeptical anyway because we've been raised in a generation where religious truths we've been trained to challenge and question. How could they really be true? So what I'd like to do with you, and I don't pretend to be able to prove this, and what I'm about to share with you is not a proof. I want to make that clear. This would not hold up in a court of law as evidence.
But I do think it is a rational basis for a Jew in 2017 to believe that this event actually took place. And two bases for this. And I think the former is the stronger basis. The first one I'll dwell on for a few moments. And that is the mass nature of this revelation. The mass nature of this revelation. Judaism to this day is the only monotheistic faith that lays claim to a mass. You know what I mean when I say mass revelation? Christianity, Islam, and most other faiths is one small sect within the Sikh religion that lays claim to a mass revelation. But without exception, Judaism is unique in this sense that makes this very bold assertion that when God revealed the Torah to the people, it wasn't just to the elders, it wasn't just to Moses and Aaron, it was to everyone. And that's why miracles, again, for the Rambam and in general, are not as important for us, because miracles are always used by other prophets to demonstrate that what they're giving over is truthful. How else do you prove that you're the real deal, that you are representing God, if you can't do anything godly or miraculous or supernatural? Right? But you don't have to do that if everyone else was there. Everyone was the same as Moshe. Every Jew was elevated to the status and level of a prophet, Nachmanides, the Ramban writes, because they heard God speak. But what does that have to do with us? Does it make it any more believable to you? And this is the argument of the Kuzari, the great medieval Jewish he wasn't such a rationalist, but philosopher. The Kuzari is trying to demonstrate to the king of the Khazar tribe that Judaism is the authentic religion, and he's arguing with a Muslim scholar and a Christian scholar, with an imam and with a priest, and there's this rabbi. And the rabbi argues that why would the Jewish people lay claim to mass revelation? Why don't we just say what everyone else says? It's a lot easier to get away with. To say that everybody was there, because, of course, you can make that up, like you can make up anything. But the likelihood of fabrication always decreases with the number of people who attest to the legitimacy of whatever it is being proposed. What do we call that in a court of law? When you bring someone in to testify in a court of law, and you bring another guy, and another guy, all to say the same thing. Why do you need to keep bringing more people in? If the first witness said it, why do you need the 10th guy to say it? It was called corroboration. Why does that make the jury feel more comfortable accepting the information? I don't know. But psychologically, we seem to be more comfortable accepting information when more people attest to its validity than when less people. I always like to demonstrate by using my train analogy, which some of you might have heard before. So you're waiting at the train. Pick a train. Give me a train.
The 2 train.
Or give me a subway.
Or the C.
The C. So you're waiting at the C. And it's the Central Park West line. I got it. Okay, so you're waiting at the C. There's like 20 other people there at the C. And one of them walks over to you and says, "Scott, I see you're waiting for the C. You know, it derailed. It's not coming. Everybody's okay. Just got a text on my phone. And everyone's fine." And he walks out of the train station. The other 19, 18 people are still standing there. What do you do?
I go and I take the one.
You got one guy? One guy convinced
one
you?
Yeah.
The other 18, 19 people are still waiting for the C.
I'm waiting.
Okay, five people then walk over to you. Randomly, they don't know you. They don't seem to know each other. It's not like, you know, being filmed or anything like that. And they tell you that the C train has derailed. 10 people come over to you, and now there's only 8 or 9 people left. All of a sudden, what's happening in your mind now? All of a sudden, you're feeling more secure that the C train actually derailed. Is anyone standing there when the 19th person walks over and goes, "Dude, it's derailed, it ain't coming," and he leaves? Anyone standing? There's always one person in my class who's standing alone. Is there anyone still standing there? What happened between the time the first guy came over to you and the 19th?
You became more convinced.
It becomes more convincing because the likelihood a fabrication is lessened when there's more and more people who attest to it. Because the chances that so many people either lied or hallucinated the same exact thing, okay, goes down dramatically with the more and more people who claim that it actually took place. And this is what the Khuzari argued before the king of the Khazar tribe, which was that why would the Jewish people lay claim to a mass revelation, which is really hard to sort of get away with? It's much easier to say one guy heard it and he did a couple of miracles so the other people would believe that it actually took place. Because some people actually believe this happened. And that God wanted everyone to hear it for two reasons. Number one, there shouldn't be a hierarchy in Judaism. We shouldn't have this class system where the rabbis and the scholars know everything and the lay people know nothing. That's not Judaism. When I teach a class many times in synagogues, there are people sitting there who know a lot more than I do about Judaism when I teach. That always freaked me out when I was a rabbi in two other shuls. Just because somebody isn't a rabbi doesn't mean they don't know tons of Torah. That's very uniquely Jewish. You see people on the train studying Talmud. They're in business. They're not rabbis. You don't have to be a professional Jew to know Torah. So that's the first thing. God wanted to make sure that everybody would be knowledgeable and learned in Judaism. Everyone. But I think the second reason is what we're discussing now. God wanted to give us a rational basis to believe in this. He didn't want us to have to only be a complete article of faith. And just like, there's no rational reason to believe that this event took place. There's no proof. There's no evidence. But we still have to struggle with it. It's still, I'm still not proving it, am I? But can you, actually? Is it possible to prove any physical, any historical event without physical documentation? Let me ask you, what happens in 100 or 200 years from now? No more Holocaust survivors are alive. A neo-Nazi group destroys all physical documentation of the Shoah. And now all of the Holocaust deniers come out of the woodwork. What basis do we have to prove them wrong? To say that 6 million Jews were killed at the hands of the Nazis? What is it, guys? Why do we believe anything we've ever learned in history? Most of the stuff you studied in your social studies textbooks in 7th and 8th grade, you never saw any evidence or proof of. Why do you believe it actually took place? Because everybody said it did, and there was no credible reason for fabrication. And it was something that was accepted by the masses. Now, does that prove that it happened? Absolutely not. We can carbon date and get a little better in terms of proof. And I will share something that I just saw in Israel, my last day in Israel. I went on a fascinating tour that a friend of mine gave. They dug up some interesting graves from the First Temple era. And I'll come back to that in a minute. So again, this doesn't prove it, but it makes for a very, very solid case that what people are believing and transmitting from one generation to the next, because so many people accepted it, doesn't, again, prove it happened. But it makes the likelihood that somebody made this up and convinced so many people of this outright lie, or that everybody had the same figment of their imagination, the same hallucinogenic, you know, narcotic. They were all on the same thing at the same time, and they all imagined the same giving of the Torah with the same words. Yeah, it's possible, but it's highly unlikely. And therefore, the mass nature of the revelation, that the fact that the Torah was given to every man, woman, and child, although you and I were not there physically, that still is very significant. For us to be able to believe that the Torah actually came from God, that that event at Sinai actually took place in the course of history. Again, there's no proof, but there is no proof in general. You have to rely on secondhand information when discussing history. It's not science, not like a laboratory you can reproduce the history in some room somewhere. Secondhand information is normally accepted when it is understood as having been accepted by lots and lots of people. The more people who accept it, the more believable it is. And that is something which I think is a very, very important idea. What I wanted to share from my tour is there are people, of course, who believe that the Torah was written by people and redacted by these scholars. The most accepted, what's called the biblical critics, who claim that the Torah was written at certain periods and certain parts were written at certain times.
So my friend, who is a very skeptical, interesting guy, he started the Halachic Organ Donor Society. My friend Robbie Berman promotes organ donation in the Orthodox community. So at the Begin Center, a block from my hotel, in Jerusalem, has anyone been to the Begin Center? It's beautiful. So the Begin Center was built on top of an old cemetery. That's Jerusalem. But they preserved certain graves. They carbon dated, they found about 70 or 80 sets of bones that they put together, 70, 80 people that they found from Temple 1, Beit Rishon. And they found an amulet of a little girl's necklace. It took them 3 years to be able to, made out of silver, it took them 3 years to be able to unfold the necklace so they wouldn't break it because they wanted to see what was written in it. Okay, and it had Berkat Kohanim on it. It had the blessing of the Kohanim. And it was dated, First Temple era is 500 years earlier than when the Bible critics say that the first part of the Bible was ever written by any human being. Now again, that doesn't prove that it came, that the Bible was given at Sinai, that it comes from God. But it for sure debunks the Bible critics who claim that it was written at that period of time. If it was written by man, which I don't believe is the case, because so many people believe it came from God, and by the way, it's not just Jews. We're only 15, 16 million. Okay, Christians and Muslims believe that the Torah was written by God. And if you pull that away, then the Christian and Islamic faiths also fall by the wayside. Because they don't deny. Christianity doesn't deny the authenticity of the Old Testament. It just says that it's been replaced by newer and better. And Islam also does not deny the existence of Moses or the giving of the Torah at Sinai. It just said that Muhammad was the extension and came later, and he is the new. But you cut out the revelation at Sinai that God gave the Torah to the Jews. Christianity and Islam were just cut off at the knees. And Judaism also. It is such a basis that billions of people subscribe to. Now again, that doesn't prove it. You can't. I used to go to Eisha Torah, used to have this discovery seminary for 3 days, and they used to use the term proof, and it was very impressive, and I'm going to share one or two other things before class is over tonight, that they shared, and it's great. And the only thing I objected to was the use of the term proof. What I'm sharing is not evidence, it's not proof. What I'm giving you is a rational basis to believe. And the best term I could use is what Lawrence Kellman wrote in his book, Permission to Believe. I'm giving you permission to believe. But it's not going to prove it. The biggest evidence, as far as I'm concerned, of the authenticity of the divinity, of the divine origin of the Torah, is in the Torah itself. Because I don't care how much Shakespeare you've read and studied, and how much philosophy you've learned, there is nothing as deep and profound as Judaism expressed in the Torah. Nothing, you know, every year we go through the same parshas. I've been doing this for a long time, and I never grow bored because there's so much depth and profundity in it. And I just can't really believe that any human being as brilliant as any person, take 10 Maimonides and Albert Einstein's and put them in a room, it could never have produced the works of the Torah. Now that's my opinion, of course. Someone else might feel differently, and everybody is entitled to their own perspective and opinion. But there are a few things, Eisha Torah, in that discovery seminar when I was 18, I took notes, I took copious notes, that they shared with me that really stood out in the Torah that I want to share with you, and then we'll finish with this. A couple of things in the Torah are a little strange unless you subscribe to a divine origin. First of all, the mitzvah of Shemitah. What's Shemitah?
Rest for 7 years.
Right, you're supposed to let the land lay fallow after in the agricultural cycle after every 7 years. Okay, nothing crazy. A lot of other societies had that too. But what's the problem? The Torah demands that the entire country not be farmed that year. Think about, it's hard for us to think in purely agricultural terms. What does that mean? How do they survive? Other peoples were doing this. If you work your land too much, you'll deplete it of its nutrients. So everybody, if this is your tract of land, so you don't work this tract every couple of years. You leave this, let it rest a little vacation for this, and then you work the other. The Torah says the whole thing can't work. Who's how are they surviving? What are they eating? If you don't subscribe to some being that's taking care of everybody. The other mitzvah was interesting, is what I was able to just fulfill, which is Aliyah L'Regel. Every Jew is commanded to leave their homes, wherever they live, in Israel or in the diaspora, and go to the temple and bring special offerings. When? 3 times a year. What are they? Pesach, Passover, Sukkot, and Shavuot. Think about that from a purely military perspective. Telling the whole world, all the dads and the male able-bodied soldiers will be in the temple on these 3 times of the year, leaving your borders completely unprotected and vulnerable to attack. Who would, in their what king who wrote this book called the Bible would demand that of their people? And there's all sorts of other kind of strange things like that. Yet my favorite one, which somebody said they were looking into, but it has to do with kashrut.
Right.
You know this one. So what's the biblical criteria for kosher food? How do you know if something is kosher or not? Meat?
It's not a predatory.
It doesn't say predatory.
It's not a predatory.
What does it say? Animals that have... and chew their cud. Now it happens to be that animals which are not predatory animals. But what happens if they have one sign and not the other? Let's say there's an animal that chews its cud but doesn't have split hooves. Is that okay?
No.
No. Or if it has one... No. And the Torah actually goes out of its way to say, don't get fooled by those 4 animals. And it mentions the 4 animals. The pig. That's how the pig became famous, by the way. The chazir. The arnevet, the hare, H-A-R-E, looks like a little rabbit. I saw one in Israel, actually. Not a hare, but the other one. The camel, the gamal, you know.
Right.
And then, I forgot the name of the 4th animal. I saw it in Israel, actually. Cause, what's that? No, H-A-R-E is the hare. That's the arnevet. The gamal is the camel. The chazir is the pig. There's a 4th. What's really interesting, though, and a number of zoologists have pointed this out, those are the only 4 animals that have one sign and not the other, to this day. So I ask you, if Moses wrote the Torah, or someone else, how did they figure that out exactly? Did they travel the whole world, which was largely undiscovered at the time when the Bible critics claimed the Torah was written by people? How did they figure out those are the only... I mean, there are all sorts of little things, and I'll tell you my favorite. And there are a lot of these verses, not only in the 5 books, but in the prophets. And this is why I became a Zionist. Because there are verses all throughout the Torah that talk about the Jewish people coming back to Israel and the land becoming fertile and green. By the way, the green line, it's like a political term. You know what the green line, because if you get up in a helicopter and you go over Israel, you can tell where the Jews are living. It's green and it's brown elsewhere. I'm not happy about that, but it's the reality. And how is it that for centuries, when Israel was dominated by at least a dozen other monarchs and empires, and it was not producing trees, it was not green, it was... Read Mark Twain when he went to Israel, how brown and yucky, excuse me, he used much better language than that, the land of Israel was. And talk to people who came, chalutzim, who came in the early mid-1900s, who dried up the swamps and literally turned it. Israel is the only net-producing, fruit-bearing tree country in the Middle East today. And it's just unbelievable. What were we going to say?
I think it's in the world.
There's
some stat that there's only country in the world that increased trees last year.
So there's all these, like, I don't have the verses before me, but there's these like prophecies and just things that they're not all coming true, but enough of them are taking place, and just things that are really strange and odd that don't really make rational sense that the Torah predicts and prophesizes, and we seem to be living it. And when you go to Israel, and you go, that's why going to Israel is so important, because it finally gives a little evidence to all of these little stories we heard growing up. You know, we went, what do you call these, ATVing up in the Gush. It was so much fun. And they brought us to, in the middle of the ATVing, he pulled everybody over. We went with my kids, it was a lot of fun. And here's a 2,000-year-old mikveh. How do we know it's a mikveh? And then he pulls out a Mishnah from the oral tradition that brings down all the technical things about a mikveh, and it was built exactly according to what a mikveh is. And it's just all of these things that are mentioned so long ago that you see. Again, it's not evidence, but you almost have to be cynical and turn your eyes away from the reality to see that there's something special unfolding, and that a lot of these predictions and prophecies have been there all along. I'll tell you one other thing that we totally take for granted, we should be very, very proud of. And that is, before peace was in, anybody know how long peace has been in for? Like, it's a cool thing to promote peace. It's like 100 years old. Okay, war was always touted as the best thing for the economy. Everybody wanted war for centuries. You know, it was, Nietzsche was like the norm. And might made right. And the greatest, you know, civilizations that promoted the greatest, you know, intellectual wisdom, the Greeks, the Spartans would take their deformed children and put them out to die on a mountain. The whole idea of chesed, of being kind and gentle and promoting peace, was mentioned in the Torah for thousands of years while the whole world is killing each other and celebrating brute force. The book of Isaiah said you will take your, help me, it's on the United Nations building, you will take your plowshares and beat them into pruning hooks, and nation shall not lift sword, and the lion and the den, and all of these verses that, from the book of Yeshaya. I have to tell you, what human being was alive it's from God? It took human beings a long time to get it, to get that there's that the values. It's all about the peace, and it's always been said, but I don't think that originated with people. I don't, unfortunately. There were just not enough people who believed in that in those days. Anyway, so these are just some of the ideas I wanted to share of why we would believe that the Torah comes from a higher place, that it wasn't written by people, even great scholars. Judaism has got a lot about scholarship and a lot about rabbis, and we're going to talk about that next week. But I want everyone to understand, when we talk about the five books of Moses, we are talking about something which comes from a higher place. We're talking about something that Moses did not write. He might have served as God's secretary. That's the way Maimonides describes Moshe. We believe that Moses wrote 13 Torah scrolls in his lifetime. He wrote the Torah down, 13, because there were 12 tribes, gave one to each tribe, and then the 13th he left in the ark, leaning on the side of the ark, which was taken to the temple in Jerusalem, built by Solomon for the first temple. And when we talk about that going forward, we're speaking really about what we believe to be God's word, even if it was transmitted by people. Rabbis and scholars, of course, play a tremendous role, and we're going to talk about that role and what is the difference between a rabbi today and a rabbi back then, the Sanhedrin. We're going to get into all that fun stuff. I did way too much talking tonight. Any questions or comments, please? We have a few minutes. Yeah, Casey.
So I find your argument very compelling. But what would you say is the reason that we continue to follow all of these rules today? Right? So, okay, it's given to us thousands and thousands of years ago. We haven't gotten any updates. But is that enough to make it relevant for our lives today?
So the reason I spent the last 45 minutes trying to articulate, mm-hmm, is because I'm making an assumption that if you believe that it comes from God, mm-hmm, and you believe that God wants you to keep this always, eternally, then that's going to mean something, even if I don't always understand everything that's in the Torah. And I think that's an important thing to try to get into a little. Mm-hmm. I have spent a lot of years trying to articulate how Torah ideas are relevant in the 21st century. That's what my whole book that I'm writing is about. But sometimes people may not see the relevance of something. Or they may see some rule in law and think it's so outdated and archaic, but then if they pull back and say, yeah, but it wasn't written by a person who couldn't foresee the future. Like, we amend the Constitution, and we can do that, and there are updates, okay, and the Bill of Rights and all that, because they were people. And how far ahead can a person see? But God, who's above time and space, must know better, and He also is the one responsible for my creation, so I've got to believe that He wants the best for me when He gives me these rules and laws to follow. So that's why I think it's a very important belief to try to cultivate. What's called in Hebrew Torah min hashamayim, the belief that Torah comes from the heavens, if you will, from God. I think there's incredible relevance in it today, but what I wanted to focus on tonight is the compelling nature of simply the authorship. Because if it's really from God, you know, let me take some more questions. I wanted to share one last thing. It was just triggering it off. Yeah.
So I'm going back a little bit. Going back to these two quotes that we read on the first page, couldn't part of it be related to the fact that the contemporaries at that time, like the Egyptians, believed in a lot of gods?
Right.
Right? And so in order to get some respect, let's say, they needed to be able to prove these signs and wonders and like play with the rock. Like, you know, I'm like imagining that scene in Prince of Egypt, right? Like they had to be able to show all the same thing, like my God for your God. But that in going to Sinai and the maybe connection of why it doesn't work after is that like it's more than that, and God had to differentiate himself but first prove that he could play at that.
Oh, that's interesting. That he could take out the Egyptian gods and then bring them to something completely different.
Right, but he has to gain their trust or respect or something.
Yeah, I mean, look, Maimonides' view that miracles are not there to inspire faith, as I mentioned before, is a unique one. Most of the other rabbis disagree with him and say that they were there to inspire. But that still does not take away from the argument of the mass revelation. It's still the mass revelation according to everybody. The question is, what's the role of a miracle? You know, I'm going to mention one other thing. Just I had the opportunity many years ago at the 92nd Street Y to, it's supposed to be a little debate between different denominational rabbis, whatever, and I was like the Orthodox zealot in the group. There was a Reconstructionist rabbi, Conservative rabbi, Reform rabbi, and I was the right-wing nut job on the stage. And we were talking about the chosen people. And I remember I gave a whole thing about chosenness, that it's not objectively, that it's not like Jews are any better, but we have a role and we have a certain relationship with God. And I went through all the whole relationship that the Jewish people have with God, from Abraham's Isaac and Jacob and Sarah and Moses. And the Reconstructionist rabbi got up afterwards and said, everything that Mark said was very, very beautiful and very, very sweet. But none of it actually really took place. And then he went on to distinguish between what he argued are historical truths and religious truths. You know, the stuff you really believe happened, history, and then the stuff religion tells you, fairy tales. And then he went on to argue, which I didn't have the time to really argue that point with him, but he made another point that I was able to argue, which is important for us to remember. He said, but does it really matter? And this is to your question. Does it really matter if you believe it comes from God or from people? As long as you can learn something really wonderful from it.
Yes.
So I asked the audience, I said, just curious by show of hands, how many people here would make a life and death decision based on something mentioned in the Torah? You don't know what to do, you're in the hospital, can I pull the plug, can I not? Where do you consult? Does it matter to you now that this body of information came from a person or God? How many of you would shell out $30,000 a year to send your kids to Jewish day school when there's a nice public school around the corner, when the material and the information that's being given is very, very nice information from a bunch of rabbis and giving you wisdom, but it's $30,000 a year? Or is it something that God commanded me to do and I'm living my... And I went through a whole series of examples of really important decisions to make in life to try to demonstrate that it does matter. And believing that this comes from a higher place. Now, many people struggle with this belief, and I'm not trying to make a judgment on anyone who doesn't believe that the Torah comes from God. But to say that it doesn't matter, and that as long as you can learn something nice from it, what does it matter, I think really just belies the truth. We want to know that the source for some truth is something greater than us, you know. Any other comments or questions? Yeah.
I just want to say, right, you know, that Hashem wrote the written and the oral Torah and everything, right? You know,
we're not talking the oral till next week, but keep going.
You know, God did not do the oral Torah, but He did not write the oral Torah.
So we're going to discuss that next week. I don't want to confuse anyone. There's a whole body of information that was passed down orally. We're going to talk about that next week. That's not what we were discussing tonight. Tonight we were only talking about the event at Sinai, the giving of the Ten Commandments, which was written down, which was intended to be written down. Just want to keep things simple, if that's okay. Because it's just simple, easy, light stuff for a Wednesday night after work. Any other comments or questions? Okay, I'm going to let you guys go. We're going to continue next week. Stick with us through this whole series. And come Shabbat, I'm going to be talking about Noah and the flood and some really interesting lessons about what happened after the flood. Getting drunk. That's what happened. Have a great night, everyone. Thank you all. What's that?
Wasn't it during the flood?
No, after.
Noah. Different stuff about Noah?